On Downtown, we welcome back to the program very talented singer and actress. You know her work with Meatloaf, of course, on Paradise by the Dashboard Light, but so much more than that. She's worked with The Clash, Blue Oyster Cult, has been on Broadway in shows like Into the Woods, on television, in Night Court, films like Hair. Her new album includes that cover of a Wilson Pickett song. The album's called Fighting Words, and we had so much fun a couple of weeks ago talking with her that we invited Ellen Foley back to the program to talk a little bit more. I want to talk about the early days here. We had so much fun. We chatted with you just last week, I think, or week before, about the new album, and we'll talk more about that, but we had so much fun. I wanted to go back and dig a little deeper. First of all, when did you know you had this amazing instrument? Did I hear somewhere along the way that you used to audition by singing Shirley Bassey's Goldfinger?
Yes, I did. That got me my first major role in the play in sixth grade. I sang Goldfinger, you know, it's about this big. And the nuns were like, what in the world? Let's get the exorcist in here. But yeah, so that was my first big break singing Goldfinger. And then I got into the play, which was, I mean, it's very sweet when you think of it. It was original, and it was about a boy who was on the river and met different people and had adventures. And I sang people. So I went from Shirley Bassey to Barbra Streisand. So I think I kind of had a sense of my power, quote-unquote, back then.
Well, that's wonderful. And you made the decision pretty young. Were you 21 when you decided to move to New York City?
I turned 21 the day before. And, I would made it slightly easier because I had a boyfriend who was a New Yorker. So we packed up all our stuff, drove to New York. I had no idea how big Pennsylvania was. That was the first shock. Like, we were in Pennsylvania for days and moved here to New York.
And got an early big break by being cast in the tour of the National Lampoon show. Now, was that Lemmings?
No, there was the Lemmings show, which was the spoof on Woodstock, and the National Lampoon show was I don't think it had any cohesive theme. At all. It was a lot of sketches. And the one that stands out for me most that I remember was I was a girl. I was very up and very optimistic. And when I walked into my apartment, I threw up my hat and it dropped in front of me because I was blind. I was blind.
A little take on Mary Tyler Moore there.
Correct. Meatloaf was my boyfriend, and he came in, and he did just unspeakable things to me. But the thing I remember most is that he was barking like the dog, like my dog, and humping my leg. So that was pretty much the level of entertainment that we were putting out there.
Now, was he Meatloaf at the time, or was he still Marvin?
No, he was Meatloaf. You know, because he had been doing theater. Well, I'll go back. He had had a record deal. He was in Detroit. It was Stoney and Meatloaf. It was he and a female singer. So he was definitely Meatloaf then. I mean, he tells the story. He began being Meatloaf when he was playing football in college, high school. I don't know if there was college involved. High school. And he stepped on his coach's foot, and the guy said, "Get off my foot, you big meatloaf." I'm sure that's just one of the versions.
So Meatloaf is involved in the National Lampoon show and Jim Steinman.
Yes. Jim was the musical director. Well, you know, which involved just him. He played the piano, and you know, because it was a review with music, and they were original songs. I'm sorry, I have very little recollection other than my leg being humped by meat. And Jim was in the middle of writing the Bat Out of Hell material, so he wanted to tag along and be around meat when he was writing it, so it would be a collaboration between the two of them.
And you've said Paradise by the Dashboard Light. Stop right there. Those three words changed your life.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would have done something. I was having a bunch of success a few years later, not too long later. I was on this show, Three Girls Three. I was on Broadway, other television. I certainly could have continued in that vein and had a successful career, but I got a music career, which is the thing that's most important to me, with those three words written by Jim Steinman.
There was a great story of a baseball coach, college baseball coach around here many years ago, was driving in a car with some assistant coaches and was scanning the radio and said, let's see if we can find a baseball game. And they say, oh, there's Phil Rizzuto. Ah.
My God.
And then all of a sudden, in you come with Stop Right There. He's, what the hell happened to the scooter?
What the hell? I hope he didn't run into a tree. You know, apparently Rizzuto, you know, they just brought him in and he just did his part. I don't know how they got him and I don't know what they told him. But when he heard the finished product, he was scandalized that he was a part of something so dirty.
We are talking with Ellen Foley on Downtown. Now, you did your first solo album, and man, I love the album so much when it came out. Night Out, some great songs on there. Working with Ian Hunter and with Mick Ronson, how was that process?
It was very good, you know. Like back then, after the Meatloaf thing, things just sort of snowballed in a very natural way because I got involved with Steve Popovich, who, you know, discovered Meatloaf, really. I mean, you have to say that. Put out Bat Out of Hell, you know, grabbed onto me to put me in his stable.
Yeah, was that Cleveland International?
Cleveland International, yeah. Right. You know, Steve... moved to Cleveland. I don't know if he ever lived in New York, but, you know, he was like a fabled A&R guy. A&R is art, I'm telling for the audience, what is it? Artists and repertoire, I guess. Right. When they was the guys who discovered people and signed. So he was at CBS. He was at Epic. He signed huge groups, and they gave him his own label. So, we did demos. I spent, you know, a couple of years looking for material. And at that point, he introduced me to Ian and Mick, and we did some demos. All the work we did pre-production was up at Bearsville Studios. It's Todd Rundgren's studio,
right,
in Woodstock, where Bat Out of Hell had been recorded.
One of my favorite songs on the album, We Belong to the Night, you co-wrote.
Correct. We Belong to the Night.
And you had bigger success with that album in Europe than you did here in America. Was that just the lack of label push behind you and promotion and all those things?
I would have to say probably. I mean, that was the era of palms being greased. You know, that was when Paola was king, and maybe there wasn't a budget to buy radio for me here. But, you know, I still perform. I'm going over there in a few months to Holland and Belgium and France and Germany. And I'm going to try to get over to England because I definitely had success there. And, you know, my new record is getting such positive response and a lot of press from over there. So I would hope to get there.
You worked, as we know, with The Clash on a couple of their albums, Sandinista. Was that as a result of your relationship with Mick Jones at the time? Which was the chicken, which was the egg there?
No, it was because we were dating. and they were working on Sandinista, and at the same time, we decided to do a record for me. And so I was like, I never felt like I was just wedged in, you know, doing sessions or anything like that for my record, but it was around the same time. And they were all involved. It was cool. It was great.
All right, so is it truth or urban legend that Should I Stay or Should I Go is based on
urban
you?
Urban legend. It's not true.
No.
It's not true. No. if you had known that relationship, you would know that that did not represent the relationship. Darling, you know, please, I'll love you till the end of time. Not happening,
pal. later on, you'd get back together with Jim Steinman for Pandora's Box and another example of great songs, great work that I don't think got the audience it deserved, including a tour de force for any actor, the want ad.
Right, right. Oh, my God. You know, I have to go back and listen to it. I did the want ad in the same show that I first sang Heaven Can Wait, show Neverland, that was Jim's right. musical that, you know, contained all the elements that Bad Out of Hell did and everything after that. Did it in D.C. at the Kennedy Center, and my character, who was Wendy, you know, it was the Lost Boys story. Wendy, I did the want ad and also sang Heaven Can Wait. So, man, I had some juicy stuff going on in that show.
You also worked with one of the great songwriters in the history of rock and pop music, Ellie Greenwich, and that to me, that's just a combination made in music heaven.
I know. Well, on my third album, there were a couple of tracks that she wrote, and that we wrote together. There's a song in there called "Boys in the Attic," which I think is so great. Mm. I mean, I keep thinking that if I had had the kind of support that I do now, I mean, I have an amazing PR guy. His name's Randy Haker. And you know, I don't know if he ever sleeps, but if I had had his kind of push that I'm getting now for some of the other stuff I did, I mean, the songs with Ellie, I mean, come on. People should have heard that.
Well, it's similar to the last album that you did with Paul Foglino, About Time. Some great songs on there. I Love Nobody Ever Died From Crying. Some really good music. But again, it didn't seem to get the push that it deserved.
No. I was not in any position. You know, there was no record label, but there was no machinery behind it. And I've been singing every day now because I actually have a gig in October. So I didn't sing for the last year and a half, but now I'm singing every day, and I sang to those songs, and they're really good. That record, About Time, it's good.
We talked a little bit with you last time you were on about creating the role of the witch for Stephen Sondheim in Into the Woods out in San Diego. And we've talked to a few people through the years who worked with Sondheim. He had some pretty firm ideas of what he wanted. Was there a level of collaboration in developing that character in the music?
I don't think, I remember that he taught me himself at the piano. There's a thing that the witch does. It's a rap. Yeah. And it's about, you know, her garden, and it's amazing. And so he and I were at the piano doing it, and he was teaching me. I mean, it usually didn't work like that. You had the music director, but it was a really one-on-one thing. So, I mean, that's as cool. I would not, it's like Steinman. You know, you don't assume to call yourself a collaborator. You're a slave to the genius.
I love that show. I've directed it a couple of times with high school kids, and I always love the reaction of the audience at intermission when they say, "Oh, yeah, that's such a beautiful show. I thought it was over." I said, "Oh, you don't even know what's coming
that's
in Act
right.
Two."
Believe me, when we did it, they thought it was over. That's right. We talked about that
yeah.
the last time. I think that show for high school kids is the most perfect, because it's about fairy tales, but. You know, I don't know if the kids are going to get all the Bruno Bettelheim, you know, implications, but it's wonderful. And you got to get yourself a good witch. And oh, he man. Had a real show-offy little girl that did that part.
Yeah. We had, I got lucky both times. I had a young woman with a big voice and a whole lot of attitude.
Good. That's what you need.
And boy, to sing Children Will Listen, it's not just children. That's one of those where the audience is on the edge of the seat hanging with every word.
Yeah. Oh, it's so beautiful. And, you know, that's another song. I haven't sung in a long time, but I did after I did the show and after I had children, sang it. Mm. And all these songs like that, of course, it changes. And like Heaven Can Wait, the difference between singing that when you're 25 and when you're not, when I'm singing it now, the whole thing about mortality and hope and, everything changes with time,
I did some great film work as well. When the word came out that Milos Forman was going to make a film version of Hair, I remember at the time thinking, well, I love the musical, but I don't know, is it a relic of the 60s? Man, it wasn't. It was such a great film, an incredible cast with Treat Williams, and man, your work doing that great scene with choreographed by Twyla Tharp. How awesome was that?
I'm telling you, I say it's one of the top 5 days of my life, filming that in Central Park, looking friggin' cool with your hair out and the Twyla choreography. Somehow I got that. So she brought me, I'm not a dancer. She brought me back to be in a scene in the LSD scene with her company. So it was me and Twyla's dancers, and I got to hang out with them. I remember we went to dance clubs and I'm dancing with, anyway, I'm getting off track. But wow, what a day, what a fun frigging day. And the choreography, it was black boys. The choreography involved these gorgeous black guys playing basketball woven around us. Awesome.
And really, Forman made New York City in many ways a character in the film.
That's right. I have to watch it again because it was such a beautiful movie, and the way they portrayed the end of it, which is just heartrending. Yeah. You know, it's certainly fleshed out because the play is really, it's not that much of a play. It's a lot of vignettes with these when you're in it, you try to find your character. But, this was, I'm trying to remember who, Michael Weller wrote the script or something?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it really became something.
It's kind of become a cult classic over the years. What was your experience making Cocktail?
Cocktail was fun. Let me think. They dragged us up to Toronto in the middle of winter. And, as they say about Toronto, but you're up there, there's probably Canadians listening. Toronto, it's very clean. Toronto is very clean. So, I don't know. But it was fun. There were all those scenes, with all tons of extras, hundreds of people with the... the guy's doing all the thing. I got to have a scene with Tom Cruise where he calls me a bitch. And I say, yeah, but I am a bitch. So those 10 seconds in the film for me were pretty cool.
I loved your work on Night Court as Billie Young. She was such a great and strong character, a phenomenal ensemble. How was that experience at the time for obviously disappointing and not staying with the show?
It was hard for me because I was really just plucked out of my life. What I think happened is they wanted Marky Post, but she had dropped out, so they had to find somebody. So they found me, and I was in LA and feeling kind of like a fish out of water. But I mean, being around the people that I was, and being able to learn from Laura Katz, Selma Diamond. Jeez, who got to hang out with Selma Diamond? But I was a little lonely because everybody had their homes and their families, and I was just, I don't know. One thing I'll say about LA was back when I was going out with Mick Jones, we were at the Chateau Marmont Hotel, and I'm a New Yorker, so we were staying there, and I was, I'm going to go take a walk. So I start walking down the street, and these cops pull over, and they say, "Can we help you, miss?" They thought I was a hooker because I was walking down the street. So, you know, it's kind of my experience of L.A. It would be different, you know, if I had felt. But it was fun. It was okay. It was okay. But it was another thing when it ended that was okay with me because I got on with my life, my sort of real life.
You've done so many different things through the years. People may not be aware that you taught at what we know commonly as the School of Rock.
That's right. Paul Green School of Rock was there for a few years, and that's when Paul Green was there, and he's completely wild. Although I've been seeing on Facebook recently that he just got his law degree. So I guess he settled down. He went to law school. He's a brilliant guy, but, you know, nuts. And I did some work. You know, the cool thing about it was that the school was divided up in groups, and every group would be working on a show that was material. One group would be doing The Who, another, you know, The Stones, and like that. So I was able to work with kids on great music. And, you know, I worked with them vocally, but it was mainly interpretation. Got them to work on the songs.
We talked about the new album, and just since we spoke with you a couple of weeks ago, it continues to do great, getting a lot of buzz, tremendous reviews. It's got to feel good for people to appreciate all of your hard work with this new album.
It really does. It's really unexpected because, it's like I said, our last record, we just put it out, and Paul Foglino, who's the writer, who's my partner, is like, "Yeah, whatever, I'll put it on CD, baby, and see what happens." But we got our PR guy and, you know, put it out in a real way. And yeah, a tremendous amount of, and it feels so great. It feels like, okay, this is happening. And if nothing happens after this for a few years, that'll be fine because I did this. But we have a gig in New York. And like I said, I'm going to Europe. I really want to get up on stage. I really do. I haven't been for a while, many people.
You miss that?
I do. I didn't think I did until all this record sort of took off. And then I'm thinking, yeah, I want to get up and do this record and all the other stuff I've been singing for years. It'll all work so beautifully together.
We talked about some of the songs on there with you. I don't think we brought up the fantastic cover version you do of Wilson Pickett's I Found a Love.
Yeah, that's fun, right?
Love that. It's great.
You know, an old white woman, you know, getting down a little bit. I always say that to me, it's my version of James Brown falling to the ground, and they come and put the cape on him and they walk him out. But I would get on the ground and somebody would have to help me up because I had bad knees, and put on my raincoat and my plastic rain hat and my little handbag. So that's, no, that was fun. That was really, because we had done it live, so I had the juice going on that.
Also love the groove you lay down on Be Nice.
Cool, right? It's unlike other stuff and unlike other stuff I've sung, but Paul has kind of pushed me in other directions. And it's a very cool, I like to say, it's kind of a sneaky groove, you know. And it's got all sorts of allusions, you know, biblical. And it's one of the couple songs on the record where there's, you know, a woman of experience is handing out some advice. This one to the guys.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I mean, Being so talented in so many areas, has that given you the opportunity to have a level of control that not everybody gets over your career? Have you been able to pick and choose a bit more than somebody who could perhaps only do one thing well?
Well, I did do a lot of things. You know, it wasn't about, even, you know, it's been a long time since I've wanted to be out there and be on the stage and do an 8-show a week show. But, you know, I think I'm picking and choosing right now, in that I'm choosing to do exactly what I want to do and be in control. Yeah.
Ellen, thank you so much. Great to have a more in-depth conversation with you this afternoon. I'm so glad the album is getting the recognition it deserves, and it's great to have a chance to talk a little more with you.
Thanks, Rich.